Welcome to the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo. This is Tom Douglas back in the house here at the Hot Stove Society on 4th and Virginia, downtown Seattle. We are so excited to be here. Thanks for you for listening. Hopefully you're in your garden or your car, or maybe you're podcasting us while you're exercising. And nothing better to do while you're exercising than to think about cabbage rolls and meatballs and halibut.
You got to stay strong.
I'm Tom Douglas. I own Sirius Takeout in Ballard, which is where Sirius Pie is, Sirius Pie downtown. And, of course, during COVID, we have reimagined Seatown Restaurant to include all of my three places there in the north end area of the market into one. It's called Seatown Market and Fish Fry. But you know what, Chef? I'm thinking about changing the
name.
I'm thinking about changing the name as a combo for all three to Seatown Fish Fry and Minute Steak.
Terry, tell him that's a weird idea.
Do you know what a minute steak is, Chef?
That is not a good idea.
Oh,
Thank you.
It's fun. It's fun. It's trashy fun. Who is this talking to me from Madison Valley right now?
Terry Rotiro, the chef in a hat, Tom. Here every Friday with you. Live from Madison Valley, owner of Luc. And we just rebuilt and covered the patio, and we're going to open that next week. We're looking forward to that. We'll have a big whoopah, six tables, and we're looking forward to have those tables and seat some people outside.
Exactly.
Along with our to-go program, which has been quite strong. We do nice boxes. We're featuring a little run of coho salmon that we had this week. And that's about it. And looking forward to the heart of spring that's coming up with all those things, those blooms everywhere, and the garden is like going nuts, and all those sprouts are coming up. That's very exciting.
I was teaching a class last night. We made spring pasta, and I got to use spring onions. I got to use my first of the season asparagus, my first of the season sweet peas, first of the season, I mean, just beautiful mint, and tarragon is so lush right now, and flat leaf parsley, and lots of dill is up and about. I mean, it felt like spring. Homemade pasta. Mm. Yeah. So good.
Love that.
Love that. All right, we're going to introduce our interim producer, Pamela Hinckley. She is going to take over for Amy for a while until we identify who's going to be next on this role. Hopefully Amy will come back and guest produce sometime. I love having you on the show, Amy. Anyway, Pamela, what have you brought for us today? You have adorned our studio with multiple green things.
Well, knowing that we're going to talk later to our nourishing nutritionist, and she's going to delve into spring greens, I raided my garden this morning. So we've got the beautiful arugula flowers, two types of mustard, baby lettuces, leeks, and at the end there's some kale ramp, because this is the time of year to nibble on every vegetable that's ramping up.
So. Kale rob. Is that you're talking about the top growth on the kale? Yeah, it's kale rob. It's kind of the new growth on the top of the kale.
Thank you.
And it looks a little bit like broccoli rob because it's got those buds on it and stuff, but they're completely edible, and they saute beautifully.
So beautifully.
Yeah, really nice.
Yeah, they're very nice, tender and everything. This is the time to eat them.
Jackie's been picking them like crazy over there. Okay, like you said, we're going to talk about leeks, a whole segment on leeks, fresh cheeses to make at home. It's time to really... You know, if you're in England right now, or in like the Isle of Jersey or someplace like that up in Scotland, this is when they're making their most luscious cheeses, fresh cheeses, because the grass is the new growth grass, and all the critters are on new growth, and it changes the taste of the milk. And now is a great time to make homemade ricotta. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. Butcher's cuts, the bavettes, the flanks, the hangers, and the skirt steaks. Delicious, inexpensive, nothing's inexpensive anymore, but delicious. What we call the butcher's cuts because for a lot of time, Cherry, you know this, the butchers couldn't sell these things, right? And they would take them home and they would use these cuts. And now we've all learned, all of us chefs have learned that, those are pretty darn tasty, which has made the price of them go through the roof. Our favorite kitchen tools, I'm going to curious what Terry's favorite kitchen tool is. Dressing up your rice, Pamela has made some candied garlic. And we're going to find out where that came from and which book. And, of course, Carly Knowles, who we like to consider our in-house nutritionist. She has that beautiful book out. Amy, what's the name of that book? Or Pamela?
It's right there.
The Nutritionist Kitchen.
The Nutritionist Kitchen. That's right. And we love calling on her. She's down in Portland and using her as our expert. Okay, my favorite taste of the week. You know, Terry, I do these evening segments for King 5 Television and have for years and years and years. And this week I made them halibut tacos. And it struck me and it struck the people, that the cameraman and the producer of that show, that how simple it was to create a halibut taco. And so I just fried my, I bought corn tortillas at the store, fried them up, because there's nothing like, you don't want to buy those ones in the box, right, that are all, pre-fried.
Right.
Who knows, are a year old maybe. And so right. I just put a little slaw in the bottom. I put some tapatio, which is like a little red salsa. And I seared my halibut with my pork rub, because my pork rub has got a Southwest flavor, cumin, garlic, chilies. And then I made a little avocado crema. So sour cream and pureed avocado and lime juice, and just finished my pork, my halibut tacos with those. Because it's spring. Halibut has sprung. And so what a simple, easy way to enjoy the first real wild fish of the year. What's your favorite taste of the week, Chef?
Well, my favorite taste is
And by the way, I only left you a minute and a half.
It's okay. My favorite taste is... it's, you know, turning all the dirt in the garden this week. All the greens that were in the garden needed to be picked. So all the kale, like what Pam brought from her garden, all the kales, all kind of different greens, leftover cabbages and so on and so forth, all that stuff brought into the house and made a giant green braise. And I tell you, we eat that all winter long. And we by the end of winter, we go, let's go into spring. We're looking forward to spring. That was so delicious. It's a nice way to say goodbye to winter. To me, I was like, that was so good to braise all those greens together. There was spinach that were put at the end. There were kale. There were Brussels sprout. There were all kind of different greens. And all those tops went into the same pan. And with a little bit of bacon, I cheated at the end, because I was like, what else could go in here that would be so delicious? Rendered bacon, bacon bits, basically like cubes, lardon, and then put into that braised green with just a little bit of stock, chicken stock, and then a big nugget of butter at the end to finish the whole thing up, because that's how you should treat them at the end of the winter. Big salute to goodbye winter, hello spring. So
very
that's
nice.
My taste of the week. It was nice to be reminded that even though we've been eating them for the last 4 months, it's still delicious.
You know, last year at this time when we opened Sirius Takeout, right, which was just a week or two after the closure of all businesses, we opened Sirius Takeout. And I was cooking Prosser greens for the first 12 weeks of spring as my warm salad. I was cooking it on a little cassette burner in the kitchen there. And I went through totes after totes after totes of Prosser greens. Up next, let's speak about leeks. They are an underutilized allium that I just love to death. And so we're going to get right into that on Cairo Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society Show. Stay with us, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio. This is Tom Douglas, and we're going to talk about leeks. And Chef Terry, I'm always I think about your mother forcing you to eat braised leeks when you were just a youngster, and thinking about slimy and gross that must have been.
It's not braised; it's boiled.
That's even worse.
Big difference. It's not braised. If they were braised, they would be delicious. They were boiled. A big pot of water, throw in the leek. They come out there like that slimy. Onion-y, slimy kind of thing. And then she would put that on the platter, and then she would give red wine vinegar, homemade. That would be the seasoning.
Did France have a version of the child protection services that you would call when she made those?
Yeah, but it's much, how would you call it? Much looser, I think.
But anyway, the officer would come to your house and say, eat the damn leeks, kid.
Or you go to jail. No.
Or you go to jail.
You know, it's funny because it's one vegetable that I really, really like today.
Yeah.
And, you know, ever since I learned how to prepare it, as soon as I became into an apprentice chef when I was 14, 15, and we actually had leeks à la grecque on the menu as an appetizer, which is basically half leeks cut and cooked very slowly in white wine, just like a fondue of leek, basically. And you serve that as an appetizer cold with a nice little dressing. And as soon as I saw that and tested that, I was like, oh, leeks actually taste good.
You know, that let's talk about leeks real quick here. So when I'm shopping at the grocery store, I walk over to the leeks, I pick them up, and then I kind of feel them. I kind of just feel how firm they are. You said in the break that you like to see a little dirt on them. You know, they're from a real garden. And then I like to kind of feel all the way up to the green tops, because you can feel inside how much of that center you're going to be able to use. Like right here, I have about a 15, 16, 18-inch leek right here, and I can feel all the way almost to about 10, 12 inches of that leek that I know I'm going to be able to use on the inside. Because so often you buy the whole leek, and people end up throwing away half to two-thirds of it, and it's just silly. It's a silly waste of money. It's a silly waste of leek. And then I like ones that these are obviously not organic because these are monsters. So somebody put some Miracle-Gro on these or something. And I like a leek that is, you know, what's the color? Like, Pamela, what's the color on that top?
It's a soft, sagey green.
A soft, sagey green on the top and a white bottom. And then, Chef, tell us how to clean a leek.
Well, I would cut them. Depends on the preparation you're doing, but most likely cut the stem off, the root system that's on the bottom, and then cut it in the middle. And you need to run that on the water and put it in a bowl of water if you want.
So can we go back real quick? Cut it in the middle lengthwise, right?
Lengthwise. Yeah, okay. Just like half moon. If you take a circle and cut it in half, two half moons. So you cut the whole leek lengthwise, and then you have all those layers of leeks inside. Then you want to get the water through that to be able to get the dirt that's stuck in there out of there, because there's nothing worse than eating a mouthful of leeks and feel like you're at the beach. You know, it's like, that's not a good idea.
Yeah, somebody didn't do the right process there.
Right.
All right, so now they're washed, and I like to take my thumbs and spread the semicircle out and let the water run all the way through. Okay, now I have I have these 10-inch long leeks cut down the center. What are we going to do next? Let's just say we're making braised leeks.
Well, I would do it. I love a good leek fondue. I was saying that earlier of the year. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, it's like you take leeks, you can cut them into inch long or into a big stock, like 5 inches long, and you'd have two per person for an appetizer. I would serve that as an appetizer for starter. So you take some butter, white foamy butter, put the leeks face down into the pan, and then let it cook very medium, slow to medium heat. You don't want to go high. You want to go medium. And then you cover it with either parchment paper or a lid on top of that pan and cook it very slowly till it braises very slowly. About 3-4 minutes into it, add a little dash of, I like a little sweet wine, and not as sweet as a Sauternes, but more like a white wine with a hint of, like a Riesling, hint of sugar in it. Just put that in there and then cover the whole pan and let it cook very slowly. It's going to braise in probably 20 minutes. You'll have the perfect leek, totally tender. Everything will be perfectly cooked. And then you take those leeks out and you make a beautiful hollandaise with tomato puree inside the hollandaise. Mm-hmm. And then you put that right on top of your leeks as you serve it as an appetizer. It's quite...
Now we're in a pan. We're on the stove. You've put your leeks down. Are you getting any brown on them at all?
No.
No
just
brown.
Keep it just white.
Okay, you're in the foamy butter. So you put that down for a couple minutes. Now you're going to put a piece of parchment on, and you're going to then cover it in foil. And are you going to run that to the oven, or are you going to stay on your stovetop?
You can do either one. Or if you have an oven at 325 degrees, you can put it in the oven. Or you can just keep it on the stove and make sure that the heat is low and check it out so that you don't run out of liquids.
Okay, so but you didn't put any liquid in the beginning. So you said wait five minutes. And then put liquid in.
Correct. Because at the beginning, you're just trying to sweat the leeks just like you would an onion or anything. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you put the liquid in so then it keeps cooking the entire leek.
And then you know, put the cover back on and then put it either back on the stovetop or back in the oven. Okay. And then when you said make a hollandaise, are you making that out of the pan juices, or are you just making that separate, like a whole separate hollandaise?
I'm making it separate while the leeks are cooking. I'm making my hollandaise. You can use the pan juice that are in there and put a little bit in the hollandaise, because when you're making a hollandaise, you always need to add a little liquid in there, mm-hmm. you know, to stop the emulsion of the eggs to be too thick.
Right.
So you can put a little bit of that liquid in there. The problem is you're cooking the leeks while you're making the Hollandaise, so you're going to have a timing issue.
Timing issue.
That liquid is perfectly fine. Don't waste it. Don't throw it away when you're done with the leeks. You know, it's like it's a liquid that you can use in many other things. Like the next time you're making a chicken or a fish, you can make a sauce from that base. Mm-hmm. Totally fine.
And so the Hollandaise, the one more question I have about your recipe is I'm making a classic Hollandaise, which is typically, you know, eggs, whipped egg yolks, have lemon juice. I always put a dash of Tabasco in or something like that. And then we're going to put in our clarified butter and make our Hollandaise. Now, are you saying add just a little squeeze of tomato paste into that? Or are you saying make a paste out of, say, sun-dried tomatoes and add it together?
No, I'm saying, well, if you can, if you have those sun-dried tomatoes, yes, that'd be great. But most likely you're going to have tomato paste in your house. Mm-hmm. I recommend that you have a tube of tomato paste in your refrigerator door ready to go at all time, but that's just me. Squeeze a little bit of tomato paste in that Hollandaise and then whisk the whole thing together, and you'll have kind of like a light tomato-y Hollandaise that will go right on top of your leeks, and it makes a nice little appetizer.
Yeah, nice and lemony. Okay, so the other thing you could do then is you could take on top of that, I'm just going to embellish just a little bit. I only have a minute, but I'm going to take a two-inch and a half to two-inch section of leeks, and I'm going to cut them lengthwise so that I have little matchsticks, tiny, tiny little matchsticks. And then I'm going to fry them in vegetable oil until they brown up and get crisp. And then on top of your Hollandaise, on top of your braised leeks, we're going to have frizzled leeks to finish it all off. And
love
we're
going
to have a, it's going to be a leek masterpiece.
Leak.
You're going to want to call a plumber. It's just so, your leeks are so good.
Oh, I thought my joke wasn't good. What the heck happened there?
And then he used it.
And then I used it.
I know.
Exactly. You're going to want to call a plumber. Ace the plumber.
Cole Beacon. Cole Beacon, stop freaking. Have some leeks.
All right. That's a good way to get your spring started, because the leeks winter over, and they're super sweet and delicious right in the beginning of spring.
Oh, they're delicious.
So delicious. Up next, it's fresh and easy cheeses, because right now is when our dairy is coming on, and typically I would say like in the UK or someplace it's best, but since our dairy over here is grown on dirt plots, I don't know that it makes a whole ton of difference. With local dairy, but in Europe, this is when you get the best milk, is in the beginning of spring. On Cairo, we're going to make fresh cheese. When we come back, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show. Chef is giving me some cooking instructions, and I'm taking it like a man. I'm Chef Tom Douglas, owner of several Seattle restaurants, and of course our to-go program out at the Seattle Warehouse, Seattle Serious Takeout, out in Ballard, 52nd and 14th Northwest. We've had so many friends come by lately when I'm out there cooking my pop-ups on the dock and stuff. We have lots of great interaction, super fun. And some good news to share, we're going to have some we're going to have some outdoor cooking classes from Hot Stove out there, which is pretty cool. Pamela is dreaming about the new Hot Stove, and so we're going to have some. What are we going to do? Some paella classes?
We're starting with paella on May, whatever that 13th or 14th, whatever that second Thursday is.
And so here's how I'm dreaming of it. I don't know if it's going to end up this way. Is that we're going to have between 12 and 15 or 12 to 20 people, as many as we can fit safely outside, cooking a paella that feeds 100, and then we're going to sell it off the dock to the 100 people. You know, obviously the people that help cook it will get a portion, but then we're going to take what's left and offer it for sale to. So you're going to help me cook and help me make a profit. Because without the profit, there is no.
I forgot about that part.
Without the profit, there is no cooking. Just having to, at least in a restaurant business.
That's an awesome project, Tom. I like that. That's
and then
very
I'm going to do some grilling classes, outdoor grilling classes, to learn how to make steaks and how you and I look at a charcoal fire maybe differently than a home cook does. How to manage your fire. So there's going to be a lot of fun stuff, and I'm looking forward to all those things coming up. That's what Pamela's here doing, is recreating the hot stove experience, so that as we reopen, we will have some new things to do.
Awesome.
So, yeah. All right. Fresh and easy cheeses to make. This is the time of year when dairy is its best because the green grass is starting to grow again. I know our neighbors' cows and goats and sheep next to us in Prosser, they're all out there on all new grass right now. As a matter of fact, the one that was out there on grass last year, I made into cabbage rolls this year. But
the circle of life.
The circle of life, yeah, and it's quite delicious. So let's talk about fresh cheese. Terry, do you like to make fresh ricotta? What do you call that in the French?
Fromage frais is what we call it. Fresh cheese, it's what it's called. Basically, it's milk, and if you don't have any rennettes or anything like this, you can just use lemon juice. You know, basically, the idea is to separate the liquid and the curd, or the fresh,
the whey,
the whey, yes, from the milk, and then you end up with a solid, a nice, beautiful, creamy solid that is ready to be seasoned into any way you want, shaped into any way you want, and so on and so forth. It's the base of a fresh cheese. So you could put it into a mold with holes in it. I'm sure you've seen those cheese molds, and do anything you want from that. Let it drain. The more you let it drain, the stronger and the tighter the cheese gets. But in fresh cheese, fromage frais, it's usually a cheese that's no more than 3-4 days old, as in it's been separated, it's in the refrigerator, and it's a curd. And you can use that curd with just seasoned with a little bit of olive oil, salt, pepper, and put that in the middle of, you know, surrounded by some beautiful roasted fennel, arugula, and what else do we have?
I like wood-fired big slabs of bread, personally.
Beautiful. And then some nuts, you know, maybe some toasted walnuts or almonds. Put that all over the dish. And you've got this wonderful appetizer, beautiful lunch. I mean, it makes a complete lunch.
So let's talk about how to make that at people's homes. So I like the more Sicilian style when I'm making fresh ricotta. And so for me, that style is using all the dairy that's available to you. So like the more, I think the classic is just using whole milk and rennet or whole milk and lemon juice. So I love it creamier than that personally. So I'm going to mix personally a quart of whole milk, a quart of cream, a quart of buttermilk, and make my a more Sicilian style, I'll call it, a type of cheese. I was trying to think of the other ingredients, the other cream ingredients, but I think that's about it. And from there, salt, and then I bring it up to about 190 degrees. Don't boil it. Whatever you do, don't boil it. About 190 degrees for about 10 minutes. And then I take it out, and I take those curds that have separated. You have to let it rest for a minute, and then take the curds that have separated, put them in cheesecloth. Now, the trick that I like the best that I learned on the internet was that instead of putting this whole big thing in one big cheesecloth, break it down into smaller bits because it drains better. And you get, you know, the big pot, you end up in the center, it doesn't drain as well as the outside drains.
Correct.
Right, the curds don't. And then my trick at the end when I'm serving it is I take those curds, that ricotta, and I put it in my food processor and I hit on, and then I walk away. I love that whipped, really whipped,
creamy texture,
custardy texture of ricotta. I'm not a big fan of ricotta with kind of the grainy texture. And so I like that kind of whipped. And then putting on, this is when you're going to the store and you go down the olive oil aisle and you see 50 different olive oils and they range from $50 down to $5. This is when I use my $50 olive oil. This is when I want to just, I have this glorious backdrop. You can also, I know what I was trying to think. I knew I had a thought. Add a quart of goat milk, right? And that'll give it some funk when you're making your ricotta. That'll give it a little bit of funk, and it works the same exact way as the rest of the milks. So,
right. And that's what I would do, too, is I would use goat milk on its own to make goat cheese, fresh goat cheese.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is nothing more beautiful than a beautiful fresh goat cheese curd. Then you can use, again, dried fruits goes really well with that. So you can regenerate some dried apricots and maybe some grilled asparagus. You know, season is coming, so you could do just a few dried apricot then you've remade. Julienne that mixed with some beautiful grilled asparagus, some arugula again, or some green lettuce that you just picked up out of the garden. And make this wonderful salad with some crumble goat cheese curd right on top of that.
Mm.
Olive oil, salt, pepper. Oh, grilled bread. Absolutely need Dahlia Bakery bull sliced grilled olive oil and salt on top.
Mm. Yeah, that would be delicious. And going back to last week, and you're torturing me with radishes, a few sliced radishes on top might be a nice little peppery.
Yeah, you like them this week, huh?
No, I said I don't like them raw. I don't like them just on their own. But I do. I like the idea that I got all my ideas, not all of them, but I got a really good recipe off All Recipes. If you go online and look at All Recipes, they have a nice the cheese that I was talking about, the Sicilian style cheese. I would just add a quart of goat milk to that recipe personally, and now I've got a cheese with a little bit more funk, a little bit. Sometimes ricotta to me just tastes like thick whole milk. So, like, why bother?
Right.
You know, that's where the olive oil comes in, and it becomes just it's like a canvas that you paint on top of.
And the farmers market are starting to open up, or they're going to start to open up. You have always somebody who's selling raw milk on those markets. That's the perfect kind of milk to make those fresh cheese. You know, it's a really good cheese to a really good milk to use for that. The other one is, I want to put a plug in for Kulisaskut cheese in Rice, Washington. Yeah. You know, they were one of my first Hallelujah cheese venture in Seattle when I had Rovers. You know, I had the basket. She walked at the back door with the basket of those pyramid ash, all goat cheeses. And I used to buy and I'm sure you did too, the goat cheese curd. And they used to say the goat cheese, just fresh curd, fresh cheese. Oh, my God. I want to put a plug for them because we don't see them as much around town anymore, as much as they used to come in the old days. But they still are, you know, making the cheese and everything. And they can UPS it to you. And I just think it's just beautiful cheeses there.
My favorite was Jacques and Marie Jobert, who used to come to our kitchen door. And they used to make Jacques and Marie. Marie was a concentration camp survivor, and Jacques was a beautiful Frenchman that was a lovely man. Anyway, they used to make fresh chèvre every week in their garage in Edmonds, and they would bring down the little wheels. They had the little molds that were maybe 3-inch rounds, and God, they were lovely. We did so much work with that cheese. They both have gone now, but what a good memory that is for us. And when he was ready to retire, he taught us how his process. And Stephen used to make it in the basement of the palace kitchen until the health department found out.
No, that's awesome. It's easy to make your own fresh cheese. It's easy.
It's just fun, too. You feel so much ownership when you go through the process. It just feels right.
Can we go back to the milk, though, Terry? And you said raw. But does the recipe always work if you use raw versus pasteurized?
Both of them work. You can use, I mean, most people are not, they can't get raw milk. So, yes, both of them work. The separation happens the same way. It's just there is more goodies in the raw milk than there is in the pasteurized milk. The pasteurized milk has been heated. So,
speaking of the health department getting worked up, they don't love raw milk either. Up next, let's talk a little bit about, since we're heading into grilling season, let's talk about the cuts that the butchers love best. On Cairo Radio, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Here we are in the Hot Stove Kitchen. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
We are on our last segment of our first hour. Don't forget, we got another full hour for you after this. But let's jump into a favorite of mine, and that's the secret chef treats that we have developed over the years. And I can think of all sorts of little bits, like when I'm cooking a whole prime rib, I'd love to nick off the end about halfway through the baking and have myself a little end slice of prime rib. And nobody knows because I did it halfway through. And so the outside browns again by the time. But all different little things that you nick off when you're cooking, whether it's a chicken wing from a, you know, chicken breast service that you're putting out or whatever it happens to be, the little oysters from the back of the chicken when you're boning out a roast duck.
Did that last night.
Yeah, when you have roast duck, little bits and pieces that you can pick off the duck as you're boning it out. Those are what we call chef's treats. And so, Terry, let's talk about the chef treats or the butcher treats that we come across now that have become very popular in today's kitchens, but used to be kind of a secret cut that the butchers couldn't really sell, and they would take home for their own families.
Or some of them were not even named, because 30 years ago, you never heard of bavette. Nobody. When I grew up, that's my mom's favorite cut of steak. When we grew up, we only had steak, you know, once in a blue moon, because that was an expensive, no matter what, it was expensive to buy meat. And we would do bavette steak, but the bavette steak would be paper thin, like, a quarter of an inch thick. And it would be wide, you know, of a cut, because it's right below the flank. So it's, you know, it's kind of like that flat piece of meat as well. But it is, in where I was, in France at least, it's the butcher's favorite cut. The bavette steak was like, because it's a little bit like the flank. It's got those fibers going through those lines, but it's very tender and beautiful taste. And you pan fry it like really fast. You know, it's like you cook it in brown butter on both sides very quickly, salt, pepper, and that's it. And it's so delicious, so tender that, you know, I was so surprised at the beginning. I was here at Rovers. I was looking for flank steak for bavette. And they would only sell it with the flank. They wouldn't sell it separated. You know, and now, because the chefs have been asking for different, other cuts, whatever. So the butcher is now breaking down those pieces. They used to be one piece. Now it's two piece. Mm-hmm. So they had to rename them, you know, or name them, you know, different places.
And, you know, when they get a name, they get more expensive.
That's right. The minute they become identified, boom.
Yeah, like the Flatiron, right? Remember when the Washington Beef Commission, I think, asked a bunch of us chefs maybe 30, 35 years ago to take the shoulder clod and try and come up with, they were coming up with the Western Griller, and they were trying to break the shoulder clod, which is generally a 25-pound chunk of beef that we get in to grind for hamburger. And of course, when you're selling that 25-pound chunk, you don't get the, even as the rancher, as the meat packer, as the local butcher, you don't get the money for it as you do for prime rib or New York steak or top sirloin. So they were looking for ways to add more value or to get more value out of the shoulder clod instead of just hamburger. And so we started playing with different little bits and pieces a long time ago, and that's where they came up with the Western Griller, the flat iron steak, you know, which is right up there by the neck. It's got that deep red. It's, you know, it's like it's, but it's just as tender as a filet mignon. It's so it's a delicious cut. So my favorite is the skirt steak, and I remember getting the skirt steak. I used to be on the road all over Seattle when I was driving for Diversified Wine Imports back in 1980-81. And I used to stop at Andy's Diner, and I always loved sitting at the counter at Andy's Diner. And that was in the railroad cars down on 4th Avenue South, south of the old dome. And the chefs there would cook off all these skirt steaks to almost rare raw, and then take them off the grill, put them in barbecue sauce, and let them sit until they were ordered. And then that was like one of the most popular dishes there. So as you're sitting at the counter, you know, you'd hear all these orders come in for skirt steak. They pull them out of the barbecue, put them onto the grill, caramelize them up, and then send out a delicious little barbecued skirt steak. And I still love it barbecued to this day. I'm not just grilled, but actual barbecue sauce on it.
So remind me, the skirt steak compared to the flank steak, where is that?
Oh, I wouldn't be able to tell you. I think it's off the belly of the cow, but I couldn't tell
That's
you exactly. But it is like it might be by the hind quarter where the hanger steak is. But it is it's got a real long, stringy kind of muscle quality to it. But when it's cut against that
the
cut
grain.
On the bias, then it's super tender and delicious. And I think it's a very flavorful steak. And it used to be $1 a pound. And in the world of meat these days, you know, some things like flank and what was the one we were just talking about from the shoulder cloth?
Bavette.
The flat iron.
Oh, hanger.
Flat iron. So,
those things
10 years ago used to be in that $4 to $5 a pound range, and at that time I would say prime rib or rib steaks were more in that $10 to $15 range, and now like the flat iron is more in the $10 range, and the prime rib is more in that $20 to $22 range for a steak. So everything has gone up, But right. The world has gone up. It's not like I'm longing for the old days. It's just that the beef prices have gone up in general.
Oh, yeah. All animals, I think, have gone up in prices. I mean, it's just more of us demanding more food. So just it is. It's supply and demand. And they've created those beautiful names. I mean, might as well use them and price them out.
Yeah, who wouldn't want to eat a flat iron steak compared to a shoulder clod?
Exactly.
You know, that's why they have marketing teams out there in the world. What's your favorite, when you do your bavette, which I think you can order at any butcher now, a little peppercorn sauce, what's your favorite way to finish it?
Just brown butter, shallots, thyme, salt, pepper, that's it.
Okay.
So just very simple. You know, if you take shallots and you chop them nicely, small, evenly, and you put it in brown butter after your steak, you know, you sear your steak in brown butter, you cook it for possibly a minute on each side because it's very thin. Mm-hmm. And then you take that off, you throw in your chopped shallots, fine diced shallots into your pan, you let it sweat really nicely, and then they become a little bit golden brown, and they go a little bit darker than that. And then after that, you take that salt, pepper, and you get the fresh thyme in there that's chopped, and you put that right on top of your steak.
Mm-hmm.
Man, every bite, you get a little bit of that shallots, thyme, and
let's
and
just
butter.
Assume, though, you got your steak now. It's resting for just a second while you're finishing your little petite fries that are so good, and they're done in a little bit of beef tallow, a little duck fat, and a little of vegetable oil combination.
You know what I look forward to? You know what I look forward to, Tom, this time of year is those new potatoes coming off soon in about a couple of months.
But they don't make good fries.
Oh, they make good roast. And that's what they pan,
roasted
man.
Roasted like, pans. Okay.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah, yeah.
Those nice, young, sweet, they're like sweet and tender, beautiful little potatoes. And you do that on the side of a nice flank steak. Oh,
lovely.
Or bavette. Oh, man.
Lovely.
That's delicious.
You just gave me goosebumps, chefs. Can you say that again?
Let's make sure we have a green salad with that.
Yeah, you got me all worked up. This is awesome. I can't wait to have a little bavette with some frites and some green salad. Get busy. Get in the kitchen. When we come back, setting up your kitchen and your prep area, what tools should you have that are most important? And get rid of the ones you don't need. On Cairo Radio, it's the Tom and Terry Seattle Kitchen Hot Stove Society Show. 97.3 FM. It's time for hour number two of the Hot Stove Society Radio Show. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
You certainly are. And chef, it's time for to kind of wrap up what we're going to do for the next hour. We're going to have a little tool lesson on some of our favorite tools for your kitchen. Of course, we're going to wrap up the show with our Rub with Love Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. Carly Knowles is here from Portland, Oregon, to help us figure out what some of the nutritional values are in our spring greens that are coming out, including, asparagus is a grass. It's a green, and it's very nutritional. And so we're going to talk about that a little bit. And I just think we really need to get off on what tools you should throw out of your kitchen. Because there's some stuff in there that just is clutter and is not necessary. So, Chef, if you had one tool you could have and one tool that you would throw away, even in your own kitchen, you probably have a tool that you would just say, when you looked at your drawer, you would say, you know what, I haven't used this in 2 years. Let's just get rid of it. What are they for you?
Well, there's one tool that I can't stand and my wife uses, and I shouldn't, you know, whatever. She likes
no,
to
go
use
ahead.
It.
She's downstairs right now.
It's called the garlic press or whatever.
Yeah. Oh.
It's that thing where you put the garlic in there. And she likes that tool, and I hate that tool because I'm like, look how much waste you're leaving in that darn tool.
Not only that, but you're the one who probably is doing garlic. The dishes, and you have to clean it afterwards with a toothpick.
Yeah, and your garlic is like crushed to death. And, just use a knife. You know, you can just pound on your garlic clove. It's going to give you so much better flavor. Plus, when you're done, you can eat that clove once it's cooked, and it's so delicious. But puree, you never see it again. You barely taste it. And I don't know. There's something I don't like about that tool. And somehow it's not satisfactory to me. There's something missing in that tour.
All right, I can hear the echo now of 1,000 garlic presses hitting the trash can right this second. Kaboom. Way to go, Chef. I hate that tool also.
And one that I cannot live without is probably my my fish spatula, I call it. It's a tool that I use on almost every single time I'm cooking just because it's so useful. So, you know, the fact that it's a flat surface to lift off anything from a saute pan, very practical, to move things around, to flip things around. It's a tool that I've had since I was apprentice, and I think then a spatula on your right hand while you're cooking, and then a pair of tongs, of course. Those are very necessary for just about any job.
Yeah, the tongs are incredibly important.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I had never used tong until I came to America, obviously. That's a long time ago.
Did you use the fish spatula?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We use spatula in France for everything. And, you know, or whatever. But I never had tongs before. Mm-hmm. And when I first came to Chicago and I saw that tool and I was like, at first I was like, what is that for? I'm like, well, that's kind of weird. And then I started using them and I was like, oh, my God. Hallelujah. This is the tool. I mean, tongs in the kitchen, I think. People who don't have tongs in their kitchen probably don't know what they're missing. But it's very inexpensive. It's probably the cheapest tool you can buy that has the most use in the kitchen. What about you? What tools are you thinking of?
Oh, I have a couple, really. I think one is not getting rid of a tool, but it's eliminating its alternatives. So, for example, a meat thermometer. There's so many analog meat thermometers out there with the little dials that you open your oven, you let all the heat out while you're waiting for that dial to kind of slowly go up from 110 to 120 to 140. Like 10 minutes later, you get the actual temperature of the roast. Whereas with those little $12, $15 digital thermometers, they tell you instantly what's going on, and you can get the oven closed back up. You don't lose all your heat, and your cooking time doesn't change drastically because you know you have to reheat the oven for it to get back to 400 or wherever it was. And so, to me, I would round up and just kind of narrow down to the one digital thermometer instead of I know my kitchen has a bunch of this and that. I just have never thrown away. You can't really replace like your candy thermometer and your barbecue thermometer because the digitals generally don't go up to 600 degrees. You really need one that goes to at least 600 for your barbecue. So that is probably the one that I would kind of narrow down. I would, and I keep extra digitals because I force them on my nieces and nephews. It's like, take one of these. This makes you a better cook. So just try it. Even on my fish tacos on the evening show the other day when I was doing a demo, even that little bit of halibut, I just put a thermometer in to show what temperature it was. I mean, the halibut was a 2-ounce chunk, and I could still know what was going on inside that piece of fish with a digital thermometer. Things that I can't do without, I mean, I think you said, right, the pair of tongs and obviously the chef knife is one of those. But I love a good, solid rubber spatula. Because it makes me nuts when I watch people cook. And it happens all the time here. And it happens in the kitchen throughout my company when I watch somebody who's just made tartar sauce. So they've done something in a bowl, right? And they pour it out and they use the whisk to kind of like, okay, they're going to scrape the bowl with the whisk. And you end up with 5 or 6 portions of tartar sauce left in the bowl that go right back to the dishwasher. And it makes me crazy. I know it's not a lot, but it's lazy and it's disgraceful to throw away the food. And it's not good for my drains and, you know, all of the above. Yeah. And the good rubber spatula changes that. And the other thing that I can't stand is a wimpy wooden spoon. I like a big, solid, heavy wooden spoon. And,
I'm with you.
You know, if I'm going to be stirring around the pot or this or that, I don't want... kitchens are full of this crappy stuff they sold in a pack of 6 different wood spoons, right? That are just tiny little pieces of nothing, and I can't stand it. The only thing they're good for is kindling in the fireplace, and that's about all they're good for. So,
one thing that I really love in that wood section, instead of a spoon, I have come to use the spatula. You know, the flat end.
The flat edge. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, the wooden spatula.
Because compared to a spoon, when you go around the bottom of your pan, there's a lot of space that's left, and it can still burn and stuck to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
But you use a spatula, a wood spatula like that, it takes everything off. You never have anything sticking to the bottom that you don't know about.
And you're never kind of scratching a metal against metal on your pan.
Correct.
The wood is nice. I agree with you. That's a tool that I probably learned to love later in my career than I did early.
I had a friend of mine who passed away not too long ago who had handmade those spatula that I have in my house. I'll tell you one thing. I've been using them for 15 years now.
Mm-hmm.
They're awesome, you know, and he made them because he was a cook and he loved to play with that. And he made them beautiful and the angle is perfect to go to the bottom of the pan and scrap everything. I think those are good tools.
I totally agree. Coming up, we're going to talk about rice, all dressed up on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. And we're back in the Hot Stove Society kitchen on Cairo Radio. We're having an in-house fight here in case you want to join us. Let us know on Facebook if you think Chef Terry will try anything, because I find him to be a bit snobby when it comes to trying anything. So we were just talking that he hasn't even tried Impossible Burger yet. It's like, how is that possible that you've not tried the Impossible Burger? Yes, Chef, because it's your turn.
I haven't been out to try the Impossible Burger. I'm telling you, if you put one in front of me, I will try it.
Okay, yeah. I'll just run around town and get you little things to try. That's what I'll do. It's Chef Terry, the chef in the chapeau, and Tom Douglas in the kitchen here at the Hot Stove. Pamela, you have a segment here that you called It's All About Rice. Tell us what inspired you and what inspired this segment.
Just recently, I saw on Food 52 a new book by Michael Twitty called Rice.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a culinary historian that is digging into regional, cultural, and rice preparations from all over the world. And the recipe that caught my attention was Meyer lemon rice with candied garlic. Because at the same time, if I were going to add an essential element to my kitchen when I start cooking, it's a lemon. I've got lemon on everything. Uh-huh. Either it's the zest or the juice. And there's also a new book just on that, Lemons in Everything. So putting the two together, rice and lemon, was something that I had to have. More importantly, though, I wanted to have the candied garlic. So
you made some. You brought some in here. Tell us the process. Well, I think Mr. Twitty believes that rice is a sponge, right? It really is meant to be a vehicle, probably not unlike tofu or some other kind of neutral flavored area. I disagree with him a little bit. I'll just say I disagree with him. I think rice has a lot to offer flavor-wise, but let's go back to the candy garlic, and maybe we'll get to my thoughts on rice
there. Yeah, hold that thought.
Yeah.
It was a super simple preparation of chicken stock, granulated sugar, kosher salt, and a boil until the garlic got soft. And then it's finished with a sauté. And that's how it got the nice golden color.
So you even caramelized the chicken stock and everything the way down until it candies the garlic.
Did you try it yet?
I haven't.
Oh,
I haven't.
Let's see. Pop one of those little morsels in.
So what I was going to say about the rice being more than a vehicle, some rice has an amazing amount of fragrance to it. And I know everyone's sick of my cabbage rolls, but the last time I made cabbage rolls, I had Genmai brown rice, which is where
you get that's
that
a favorite.
Genmai tea, right? That really fragrant brown rice tea. Well, I used that as my rice in my cabbage rolls, and it changed them incredibly compared to the ones I made just a couple of days ago, where I just used a typical long grain brown rice. And the rice is a texture in that. It's the sponge in that. It soaked up all the fat from my turkey and my pork and my beef. But it has no presence other than the texture. And I get it both ways. Whereas the Genmai one, to me it was, wow, this really changed everything. I'm going to do this again. I like that. So
I like jasmine rice, too, for the same reason, Tom. It's a very fragrant, beautiful, delicate rice. And, you know, you just steam it by itself. And I think it makes a beautiful garnish to any kind of, especially if you do like a steamed fish of any kind. I think it's a beautiful flavor addition by itself, you know, without having to mess with it too much. You know, just put a couple pods of cardamom in there, and that will jasmine rice and a couple pods of cardamom makes a beautiful side garnish to a lot of things. So yes, rice is not always necessary with a lot of stuff. But for me, one of my favorite way to make a base rice is to do it pilaf style, which is basically butter, sweat some onions, add the rice, fresh herbs, dried herbs, I mean, chopped in there, and then mix the whole thing together, a little bit of stock, could be vegetable stock or chicken stock, and then cook it down and then call it a day. And the good thing about rice pilafs, and I like, is once the stew is made, you fork it up out of the pan, put it in the bowl, and then you can keep that in the refrigerator and have different usage for the next couple of days. Mm-hmm. But it's a great base for a lot of things. That's all.
So, Pamela, going back to your thoughts on this, do you keep a lot of different rice in your house?
Yes,
in your house? I do, too.
I was wondering if I could narrow the pantry down, if there was one workhorse rice. But as we dig into it here, I see, no, you probably need 10 times, because I'm not going to throw away my arborio. I need that.
Right.
And I'm new to
arborio for risotto, right?
For risotto. Mm-hmm. And I have just started with the Calrose and sticky sushi rice.
I love that rice. That's my workhorse.
I never used it before, and now I'm in love with it. Mm-hmm. Have started doing having it cold, like you said, Terry, so that for other uses when you need to fry something up. But I think what I'm looking for is the perfect one for Persian rice, because I really love basmati, and then stirring in all the dried fruits and nuts. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, to me, that is rice heaven. So I was wondering, do I have to have the basmati too, or can I use my Calrose? Or,
you know, I don't know that answer. I know there's my favorite little Persian grocery is over on Lake City Way called Goodies, about 137th and Lake City Way.
I love that store.
And they would be able to answer that, I think, of the best rice for that kind of Persian rice that sticks to the bottom of the pod that has saffron in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They would definitely know the answer to that.
I think basmati is definitely a delicious rice as well.
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
A rice that I think is terrific and also works well in my cabbage rolls. Who knew? Wild rice. It has a nutty quality, a real nutty goodness about it that is awesome. And it keeps its chew. No, it has a real husk on it, right? And so it keeps its chew. And it's hard to overcook wild rice.
Right. Does it ever get soft?
And brown rice, too. I like brown rice from time to time. Depends on the dish that we're making, but brown rice is a good accompaniment with salted mushroom. It goes well. The woodsiness of the mushroom usually incorporates well, especially, you know, now we have morels coming into season. You sauteed some morel and then you put that in your brown rice. Mm-hmm. It's a good dish on its own with a poached egg right on top of that. Makes a fabulous breakfast with some spinach right around it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe somebody in our listening audience can tell me if wild rice is actually a rice. I think it might not be. I think it might just be a grass or
a grain,
a wild grass. Yeah,
grass.
I don't know that for fact, but something in the back of my head is telling me that it's not really a rice. Toasted? You ever do toasted rice, where you actually toast it before you cook it, like you would say? A lot of times when you make paella, you saute the rice first, right? Or even a risotto.
That's very beneficial add-on, I think, to get that little brown character on your rice.
And then, of course, when I'm making rice, I think the question always comes up, stock or water. And I personally am a water person because I want to be able to control where I'm going with that rice. And so generally, I'm a water person when it comes to making rice. And same with polenta, by the way.
Do you soak, though?
Nope, I don't soak and I don't rinse.
No soak, no rinse. Okay.
But, you know, that's very unusual compared to most Asian cultures, I would say. Terry's just shaking his head.
Well, I mean, if you buy a 5-pound bag of Calrose, you can rinse your rice off before you put in your rice machine or rice cooker. You just rinse it up first.
I love the little sweetness of sushi rice when you've taken the rice, you cooked it, and then you kind of cool it with a paddle and some rice vinegar at the same time, and that is so delicious. Okay, next up, Carly Knowles is going to be here to talk about spring baby greens and where do we get our vitamins from and how to cook them, maybe, right here on Cairo Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society show. Stay with us. We have food for thought, tasty trivia coming up after that on 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society show on Cairo Radio. It's Tom Douglas.
And Thierry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And Pamela, our producer, is here. And Pamela, you've invited our good friend Carly Knowles back. She is the author of The Nutritionist Kitchen, which is rocking it all over the country right now because people are cooking more and more at home because of COVID, and they're wondering what they're putting in their gullet.
Absolutely. And the reason we're so attracted to Carly is her approach to food and recipes being nourishing, and food is medicine. You know, your regular Western doctors don't ask you what you're eating, but you are what you eat.
Right.
So that's why we're in love with her.
So welcome back, Carly, and congratulations on being a new mom.
Oh, thanks, everyone. It's so nice to be here. Thank you.
And today, what are you excited about that you're going to share with our audience?
Oh, my gosh. So I don't know about you guys, but you're in Seattle. I'm in Portland. Spring it has officially sprung. Mm-hmm. You guys feel it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's bursting.
Yeah, right? And so all the – it is bursting, and it's so perfect. And it nutritionally, I'm seeing a shift as well, like in our farmers markets and the grocery stores. It's meeting our needs. And I talk about this in my book a little bit. As we enter into the spring season – we're getting some of these detoxifying bitter greens and baby greens that are really great to help us kind of break out of that winter hibernation that we've been in and get our bodies prepared for what's to come. Higher energy, higher fiber, get our digestion going. I'm really excited by probably the greens. And then I have a whole list of veggies that I'm stocking up on.
So when you say, Carly, when you say detoxifying, are you being specific in some of the areas of the body that might carry more toxins, like your liver or maybe your kidneys, you know, things like that? You know, are there certain vegetables that are good for cleaning up some of those toxins that maybe have been become lulled into our system over the wintertime?
Absolutely. So and to go one step backwards, I just have to clarify, our bodies do an incredible job naturally at detoxifying for this exact reason and other reasons. We have natural detoxifying, they're called organs of elimination. So our skin, for example, is actually an organ, and it's an organ of elimination. So when we exfoliate, and it naturally does that, you know, people use the sauna, that can help us, but we're already built to naturally detox. Our liver, you named it, that's a really powerhouse detoxifier of our body. And I bring that up because it's important that people know they don't have to do these like crazy crash diets or juice cleanses or, you know, whatever else is out there, that kind of gimmicky diet focus approach. We actually do it. We actually detoxify naturally. So yes, and there are things that help. One of the biggest components for that would be that group of vegetables, like cruciferous vegetables. I don't know if you guys are familiar with cruciferous vegetables. I'm sure you are. Some cruciferous vegetables that I like include like kale, collard greens, radishes, broccoli, cauliflower. They're really the hardworking vegetables in the body. And they contain something called sulforaphane, which is what actually detoxifies. That's the big one that you want to pay attention to. So really, instead of getting into all that nitty gritty, I say focus on those cruciferous vegetables because they contain a lot of that detoxifying nutrient.
Say that nutrient again. I didn't, the name
it's
of it.
It's a hard one. So so you can think of like sulfur. So it's sulforaphane.
Sulforaphane.
So it's S-U-L-F-O-R-A-P-H-A-N-E, sulforaphane. So it's naturally detoxifying, specifically liver detoxifying, which is, again, our liver does something like 400 plus different things in our body. Like, it is truly our powerhouse organ. It's incredible how hard it works for us. And without a lot of effort consciously from us, you know, I mean, yes, let's eat these beautiful foods and focus on these cruciferous vegetables, but it's just working on our behalf, you know, day and night without much you know, we don't have to think about that too much. We don't have to go on that crazy juice cleanse to get the benefits of that.
I'm always thinking about my liver, and I try to reward it with really delicious red wine and very high, very high-end whiskey, and and lots of tap water.
So that means we have to up our cauliflower intake.
Exactly at the same time. Chef Terry, do you have a question for Carly?
Yeah, I was going to ask Carly, do you know if there's a huge difference between cooking those items or raw items, as in cabbage, kale, and all that? Is it?
Yes. I want to just blow your mind here, because there's something I learned in my research in grad school. I went to Bastyr University in Seattle, and I'm so lucky I got to really look at food and how food can be transformed into our medicine. That's the base of the program, and that's the focus of my career and my book. And something I learned that is just so fascinating to me, so those cruciferous vegetables, so again, Brussels sprouts, radishes, broccoli, etc., if you chop them, if you cut them and expose their cellular structure to oxygen, okay, as simple as that, for multiple minutes, you actually increase their enzymatic activity and create a more potent food. So just by chopping it and letting it sit on your chopping board, your cutting board, for a few minutes, actually increases their nutrient density. That, to me, is like one of the most accessible, you know, today, right now, things that we could do to boost our nutrition. And how
so
easy
make them into a slaw.
Chop your veggies.
So are you saying then
exactly.
Don't cook them?
So,
oh, yeah, okay.
No, so okay, so that'd be step one, you know, like expose them to the elements, let them be there for a few minutes, then cook with them. When it comes to cooking times and temperatures for preserving nutrients, we've all heard steaming, right? We've heard steaming is probably the best way to cook your food. And that's not untrue necessarily, but that's not the full picture. So depending on the nutrient, we need a specific amount of time and temperature. So it's not across the board steaming is the best. And frankly, steaming, as you know, both of you, Terry and Tom, steaming might not celebrate that particular food item, that ingredient, to the best of its ability, you know, and so you might have like a subpar taste. So then what's the point if we're not eating it, you know, we're not enjoying it while we're eating it, so then we don't eat it, who cares if it's more nutrient dense? So it's a balance, but, you know, greens, little baby greens, these kind of delicate foods, they definitely will degrade faster and lose more nutrition. But specifically when it comes to like these greens that we talked about, spring greens, you will lose your vitamin C, some vitamin A, B6, like some of these really special vitamins that make them so nutritious. You will lose them the longer you cook them and the higher the temperature. So they might actually benefit from a light saute or from a quick steam. But then there's some hardier nutrients like the vitamin K, for example, that's found in every green, that can withstand, you know, more heat. So I think it's a balance of texture and flavor with that nutrient density or you know, composition. So it's really case by case, which is kind of an annoying answer because we all want just that one answer, don't we?
Oh, but life is more complicated than that, so...
Carly, earlier we were talking about all the rhabs that the plants are forming now in the spring. Would they be candidates for raw, steam, sauté? How do you like them, and which ones do you eat?
Raw greens specifically. So, yes, when we eat greens that are fresh in springtime, they tend to be the baby version, the smaller version, and thus more tender. So arugula, baby spinach, baby kale, dandelion greens, radicchio, although that's a little hardier. They tend to be nettles. They're soft and small and tender, and you don't need to cook them for very long. They have a ton of flavor, and they're loaded with nutrition. The sun hasn't beat them down. The water hasn't flooded them out. So we're actually eating the, like, freshest, most nutrient-dense version of them. And then as we, you know, as they age and as they spend more time, not all greens, but many will start to lose some of that nutrition. So right now, a raw version of any of those is perfect because they're tender. you know, as we get to the end of the summer, I would say let's definitely chop, at least massage, if not fully cook some of our greens, blend them, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Lovely. I can't wait to get going. I think that the idea that just putting all these greens in a blender and drinking it probably makes more sense right now.
It's a great way to enjoy them. Yep,
well,
totally.
If cutting them on your counter helps them get better, it seems blending them is even more crazy than that. So anyway, we've been talking with Carly Knowles, the lovely person who wrote The Nutritionist Kitchen, was educated right here at Bastyr University over in Juanita. And so you went to that one, right, Carly?
I sure did, yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right, and she also talks, her book talks about whole foods as everyday medicine. So I would get out and get a copy of this. I know it's become our Bible here on the show, so we love this. Transform your diet and discover the healing power of whole foods. Carly Knowles. When we come back, it's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge, brought to you by Rub with Love on Cairo Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. It's time for our Rub with Love Tasty Trivia Challenge. You know, our trivia challenge is made possible by Rub with Love, and it's handcrafted, versatile spice rubs, sauces, and mustards that add a flavorful kick and a whole lot of love to just about any meat, fish, or vegetable made in our kitchen right out there in Ballard. Look for Rub with Love products in your local grocery store or butcher shop. Find them online at Tom Douglas. Go to Bartell's. Go to any grocery store. You name it. They've got our Rub with Love. All right, Pamela, who are we playing for and how do we play the game?
We've got three contestants who are going to each get five questions. We have a wonderful winning prize that is a combo of the steak rub to bring out the great Southwest flavor in the butcher's cuts we discussed today, and the veggie rub for spring vegetables and great in those creamy fresh cheeses. And then to round it out, the winner's going to get the garlic teriyaki to dress up your rice. And we are playing, our winner today is Lori D.
Nice.
So,
Lori La Di Da, congratulations.
And the loser pays to get all this shipping to Lori. So we're going to start with Terry. You're up first.
Here we go.
It's multiple choice. From which part of a plant does a fruit typically develop? The leaf, the flower, or the trunk?
The flower.
The winner, correct. Number two.
I don't know that people know that Carly has stayed on the line with us to play.
She's playing number two.
Okay.
Yeah. This fruit is often grown in many Asian countries and is considered one of the stinkiest in the world. What is it? Durian, rambutan, or persimmon?
Durian.
Man, he is smoking it today.
Yeah, he sounded disgusted when he said it, too.
Well, because, you know, my last experience with durian was not very pleasant.
Yeah.
Somehow, I think they must have left some of the skin on there somehow.
Ooh,
I don't know. It was not very pleasant.
You're two for two. Number three. This is a tough one. Which vegetable became the first one to be grown in space in 1995 by NASA? A, broccoli. B, eggplant. C, potato.
I don't know the answer, but I'm going to guess. I'm going to go with broccoli.
It was a potato.
You know, that would have been my other guess.
What was that noise you just made, Pamela?
I know, it was kind of like the mad buzzer. I'll get better at that. Okay. Which one of the following fruits is not part of the rose family? Avocado, cherries, apricots.
Apricots.
Avocado.
Fine.
I didn't know they were all in the same family.
Fine.
Finally, carrots are particularly high in which important vitamin? A, C, or E?
A.
Correct. So we got
Woo-hoo!
Three good ones for two. This is going to be a tough competition. Carly.
Is that A for A-site?
Oh, God. Carly, you're up now.
All right. Carly is, remember, from the last segment, stayed with us. And she's got her book out called The Nutritionist's Kitchen.
She's going to ace this. Number one.
Oh, I hope so. No pressure.
Bubble and Squeak, a traditional British breakfast dish, is made from which two vegetables? Cabbage and potatoes, carrots and peas, tomatoes and Brussels sprouts.
Cabbage and potatoes.
Yay! Number two. Woo-hoo! Approximately how much of a cucumber is water? 30%, 70%, or 90%?
30%.
Nope. It's 90%.
70. You didn't hear me?
It's 90. True or false on this one? The flowers on cucumber plants are not the kinds you can eat, but the zucchini flowers are edible.
Well, I know that zucchini flowers are edible, so my guess is true.
True. Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Good work. Which of the following veggies has toxic leaves but an edible stalk? Celery, Swiss chard, or rhubarb?
Rhubarb.
Rhubarb. And finishing up.
Rhubarb, isn't that a shame? They're so beautiful.
They're so beautiful.
And large.
Well, okay, you must win the next one to beat me.
Yep. It's tough. It's tough.
Ooh, okay.
Which of the following statements is true about nectarines? They are a kind of peach, they are a cross between peaches and apples, or they are a cross between plums and peaches? That is tough.
I believe they are related to the peach.
You're right, and you pull into the lead.
Whoa!
Ooh, okay.
Four out of five. Yeah.
Nice job,
Carly.
Yeah. Nice job. Tom, are you ready?
Tom, you got to do four.
I am ready.
All right. Which gas is produced by most fruits when they start to ripen? Would it be methane, acetylene, or ethylene?
Ethylene.
He's coming out strong. Correct. Number two. The cultivated garden strawberry originated in which continent? Europe, South America, Asia, or North America?
The cultivated version, not the wild version. I will say North America.
It was Europe. The herb saffron comes from what flower?
Crocus.
Oh, man. Yes.
Dang.
Garlic belongs to which flower family?
Allium.
Not on the list.
No.
Daffodil, Lily. Rose. Yes, you show off. And this one isn't fair, but we'll see if you were paying attention.
Okay.
True or false, you can increase the nutrient contribution of cruciferous veggies by letting them sit out for several minutes after chopping.
Absolutely
them.
True. I listen to Carly like she's my nutritionist savior.
So we have a tie, Carly and Tom.
No, there's only one loser, has to pay.
So
no,
tell me
I'm,
how it
I'm
works.
The one who lost.
Okay. So
check is in the mail, Tom.
Terry, right. That's $7.95 you owe for shipping. I plan to take it out of your hide if you don't show up with some cash soon. You owe me for a few. If you want to be part of the show, you can join the community on Facebook at Hot Stove Society Radio Show. You're listening to us on the Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. The show is produced by Pamela Hinckley and Amy Richardson. So long, Amy. So long.
Bye.
Sound and production by Sean McFadden. And our editor is Sean. Don't call me Del Torre. Also, remember, if you miss any episode of our Hot Stove Society show on Cairo, you can listen via podcast. Just subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app.
Thanks for listening and have a fabulous weekend.
Thank you, Carly.
Bye, Carly.
Thanks, everyone.